Everybody here this morning, and we will start at the top of our agenda today with a work session on House Bill 2299. We're in work session, but I want to receive some testimony on some amendments we've got on this today and take a fresh look at it, and we'll follow that with 3610, which relates potentially or to some extent. But let's start with 2299. Mazin, if you could bring us up to speed on the amendments.
Okay, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we have for this week three amendments, I believe, only two probably in your packet, the A8 and A9. A7 is a version of the A9, and the difference between, I believe, I'm led to believe that the difference between the A7 and A9 and has to deal with the exemptions that were talked about in the last time we had a hearing about this, where you have an ability to give the exemption for a firm if they don't meet the requirement the first year, that they still will be eligible to go for the second, third, or fourth year-by-year type of thing. The A7, as I heard about it, and I haven't seen it, It will give the exemption anyhow. The A9 gives the exemption year per year. And that's the difference, as I believe it is. The A8 modifies the A6 amendment to bring in line the way by which putting the special districts, local districts in the agreement of how to give the exemptions for the SIP, the Strategic Investment Program.
Well, now, let me catch up here. We had the one amendment from Albany Millersburg Economic Development Corporation last time. And which amendment was that? They didn't have it. That amendment really didn't do, they didn't have it, did they?
No, they did not.
They're saying that's incorporated in the A9s?
Yes, sir.
Okay, yeah, come on up. Kathy? Would you see if Representative Close is available? She might have wanted to come down and talk about this. Yeah.
Chair Shetterly, members of the committee, I must apologize because last time
First,
I was...
First, you must identify yourself.
Oh, yes,
for the
I
record.
Must. And I got your name right this time. I'm Mike Burton. I'm the Assistant Director of the Economic and Community Development Department, and I'm here to testify on behalf of the Department's Bill 2299. And the last time we were here, I had not seen the -6 amendment, so I spoke to it, understanding that it was Mr. Pascone's amendment. It was not. That was the -7 amendment. -7 and -9, as staff has reported, cover the same issue. That issue is the one that Mr. Pascone presented. The difference between the -7 and the -9 is, as staff reported, in the -7s, the firm will get the exemption whether or not they meet the requirements. It was not our sense from the discussion that we were party to last week that was the intention of the committee. The -9 amendments would allow for the firm to not meet the criteria but would make a payment anyway. But keep the door open for any subsequent years, which I understood to be sort of the sense of the discussion. So the -9 is meant to reflect Mr. Pascone's issues, but to get to the sense that we were hearing from the committee that they didn't meet the conditions, they don't get the exemption now, but if in the future the economy turns around, they're able to perform as they projected, they would still qualify for the exemption. So it preserves the rights, but has them making a payment for those periods where they don't meet the threshold requirements. The -6s and -8s are something I should have discussed last time, but I wasn't looking at it.
That's all right.
Those are refinements of language that we've been negotiating with the special districts, counties, cities, ports, and others, and are meant to provide a mechanism whereby in the strategic investment program there is a payment in lieu of taxes once a firm meets a cap on the taxing threshold. That is, under current law, $100 million, and that payment in lieu is called the community service fee. That's limited to $2 million. We have proposed in the bill that there would be a scaled-down rural version of the same the strategic investment program that would be limited to taxes of $25 million, the first $25 million investment would be taxed at the normal rate. Beyond that, there would be a community service fee. And this amendment gets at how that community service fee is distributed. It can't be distributed proportionally to the taxes, otherwise it is a tax and would require a vote of the people. The mechanism we're trying to perfect here has all of the affected districts, cities, and counties, as well as special districts, come to the table and negotiate how that community service fee would be allocated. If they can't come to an agreement, if 75% of them can't come to an agreement, then the Economic and Community Development Commission would make the final determination as to how the community service fee will be allocated. We support that amendment and are awaiting your pleasure on the -7-9 question.
Okay. Where are the dash sevens? We never did see those.
No.
We never saw the dash sevens.
I did.
You did.
In this case, I actually saw the amendments.
Yeah. but we don't have the sevens in front of us. So we have the A6s, and we don't have any earlier amendments in front of us, right? Is A6 the...
We have A5.
No, A5s.
The A6s would be superseded by the A8s, would address the same issue in language that has been signed off by the county, special district, cities, the department, and everybody
else. What about
else.
The A5s?
This is my second thing.
Is your testimony on the A5s?
Yes, Mr. Chair, would you?
Why can't I find them? Go ahead, Mazin.
The A5s, just put the...
Oh, there they are. Yeah. That's right.
The definition of what is a rural area within the urban growth boundaries,
right,
and so
right.
on.
Okay, we submitted yeah. that.
Those were the amendments that take care of the newly incorporated.
That's right. That's right. Okay, so we have A5s, we have A6, except those have been
superseded by the A8s.
So we don't need the A6s. We have the A8s that take care of the A6s, and then we have the A9s that deal with the Albany-Millersburg issue. And as I recall, our approach was if you don't qualify this year, you don't lose the exemption for all future years. You're just suspended, basically, from the program for the year that you don't qualify.
Chair Shetterly, members of the committee, I would comment on that briefly. That's exactly the case. And there are a couple of county assessors in the audience today. From my perspective, what that does is not a bad thing. If it's your pleasure, that would be fine with us. It does create what is essentially an annual certification for the enterprise zone for those firms that would be qualifying under that mechanism. And that would entail some additional work on behalf of the assessors. So that would be the trade-off if you chose to go in that direction. And the department doesn't have an issue with changing the law as proposed by Mr. Pascone. It might be fair to ask the assessors how they feel about it.
We'll do that. Okay, questions for Mr. Burton? Yes, Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the A9s, okay, if I understand it, if you didn't qualify in the first year, the option is open in a subsequent of the 5 years if you do qualify. What if you did qualify the first 2 years, didn't the third? Does this make you qualified in the fourth? Is that...
Chair Shredder, Representative Berger. The current law already allows for that circumstance, which is why the department doesn't have an issue with this.
Okay.
Where the current law is lacking is it doesn't address that first year circumstance.
Okay.
So there already is an annual certification.
Not really. In the current law, if you fail to certify 1 year, you make a payment in lieu of taxes that year.
Right.
If you fail to qualify a second year, you lose the qualification entirely. So it is somewhat different. But this one would essentially make it an annual certification based on that first year.
Okay. We'll hear from the assessors. Any questions? Further questions for Mr. Burton? All right. Thanks very much. Who's here from the counties? Behar. Mr. Linhart. Did special districts want to talk about this? No.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Lanier, Columbia County Assessor, representing the Oregon State Association of County Assessors. I'm not sure I'm not really familiar with the Linn County Millersburg problem, and I've read over the amendments, and I don't see any major complications with them. I thought the current statutes already allowed that if a company missed a filing deadline the first year, so that they would not get the exemption the first year, then the second and third year they could still, you know, they could still get that second and third year of the exemption. I haven't had enough time to research the problem, research the statutes, but obviously the statutes don't cover the current problem, or else they wouldn't be coming forward with an amendment. We essentially look at these companies every year anyway. We send out an annual statement of compliance every year. House Bill 2299 actually institutes an annual claim form that the companies would have to file every year of the exemption plus the year following the end of the exemption, just to make sure they've, you know, kept up their employment levels through the end of the exemption period. So that would allow us to pick up on these kinds of companies that for whatever reason missed the first year, maybe missed the second year, but then would want the exemption the third year. So I don't, administratively, I don't see a big problem. Assessors can do anything.
We'll remember that.
Mr. Chair.
All buildings in a single bound.
Yeah, right. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Tony Hyde, and I have two hats today. One is president of the Association of Oregon Counties, and the second is a commissioner from Columbia County. As a president of the association, we understand that recodification is very important and needs to be done so they can make things clear and get rid of some of the issues. However, as a commissioner from Columbia County, I worry about some of the policy pieces in here. More specifically, I worry about Section 34C and how it affects Columbia County. In Columbia County, we have two pending power plants.
Commissioner, you're not talking about any particular amendment now. You're talking about the 34C.
I'm talking about 34C in the bill itself.
Okay.
We have two pending power plants under construction right now, or under permits. One of them is pre-certified for an enterprise zone, and the other one is about to pre-certify. We also, in that same area, have an urban renewal area district, which has a plan. And in order to implement that plan, we have a very delicate funding scheme. As you probably could understand and appreciate, it's very hard in the first place to have an urban renewal plan along with an exemption that exists because of the retirement of debt for that gap financing period. This would take the 2 years of construction and remove that and allow them 2 years of additional years during construction up to. That would be very problematic for our very delicate financing plan right now for that gap financing. So that's an issue for us.
Okay. And how do you propose we fix it?
Well, my proposal is to not have 34C in there. Because that's around, I'm just guessing, that it's around $5 million hit to us that we hadn't anticipated. And I might add, neither had the power companies that were planning to build. We had long conversations about that 2 years of exemption that they're no longer having.
Representative Bridget?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do you happen to know how many counties would be affected? Because Coos County also has an urban renewal district with an enterprise zone.
I do not. I can find out if you'd like.
Mr. Chair,
as I understand, though, the specific issue is that you've got a deal that this would affect. It's not right. Something prospective. You could factor that into whatever you negotiate and try to put together. But your problem is that you've got this would affect the current agreement. Is that it? That's just now coming together.
Correct.
Okay, Mr. Burton?
Chair Shetterly, members of the committee. This is an element of the bill that was driven by the interest of a company building an electrical generating facility in northeastern Oregon. That company did not qualify because construction lasted longer than they thought. That they had to pay taxes on a facility that wasn't in operation. Under current law, for most businesses being, or most enterprise zone eligible businesses being built in Oregon, there is a construction in progress. For the period of time where the facility is being built and is not productive, property taxes are not paid. The exception is, excuse me, are for those businesses which are, excuse me again, are called centrally assessed property, and most specifically, we're talking about large electrical generating facilities. In the past, when electrical generating facilities were built by the power company that served you and sold the power to you and delivered it to you, it was not an issue. It was passed along as part of the rate. Now, with a new class of generating facilities called merchant generating facilities that produce power for sale on the market, the fact of having an exemption available or not during construction, or more to the point, paying taxes before the facility's productive, is a cost of, essentially cost of construction, adds to their cost of delivering the energy. So it can affect the marketability of the power that will ultimately be generated by that plant. The proponents of this piece of the bill, as I said, an electrical generating facility builder, felt that was an issue and came forward with this piece. So it's not our issue. They're not in the room today, and I'm trying to present their perspective. It is a trade-off, and it might be, for the sake of Columbia County, one solution might be to have this take effect in 2 years. Well, that won't work for the plant that's being built now.
I guess, Representative, was that Hess?
Yeah. this issue came up, and it was a little bit troublesome in the previous committee because of some thoughts that, well, why would we provide an incentive for someone who's already made the decision to go there and give them essentially an incentive, and after they've made that decision, it was explained to me that ultimately they wouldn't get any more tax benefit than they would otherwise have received. But it did raise that question of why are you giving this incentive now that they've already decided to build?
Chair Shetterly, Representative Hess. As I said, this is not the department's issue. We aren't putting it forward. The company will pay more, or would be excused from paying property taxes that they would otherwise have to pay. I'm only speculating. I would guess that they didn't understand the construction in progress law and got to a place where, because construction was delayed, it became a big deal to them and are looking for a retroactive fix. So the question is, do you want to do it or not? The department has a small agenda here, which is that in this one regard, enterprise zone businesses are not treated the same. We're interested in this proposal just because it would mean all enterprise zone businesses would have the same circumstances. But it's not a big deal.
Mr. Chair, perhaps, and I apologize. I just found out about this morning, so I'm kind of thinking on my feet. But I could offer up this. With our urban renewal plan, the way it's set up, we are actually allowing the companies to offer a lower rate, because within the urban renewal plan, we are doing some of the infrastructure that the plant would otherwise have to create themselves. More specifically, the water system, which is going to be very expensive, around $6 million. Perhaps if there was an either-or, whereas if there was a urban renewal area within the enterprise zone, then that wouldn't be offered. Might be able to address that issue.
Well, I guess that was my thought. It seems I'm not so offended by the 34C, and that came out of the previous committee. It's there. I think the problem is that may not have the effect of that may not have been comprehended by everybody beyond just the specific project that was in mind. It seems to me there ought to be a way of one more amendment, perhaps, that builds some walls around that and doesn't get in the way of other projects. And maybe you've hit on something there that would work. John?
Chairman Shetterly, my name is Paul Chalmers. I'm the Director of Assessment and Taxation for Umatilla County. The project I believe Mr. Burton's talking about is the Calpine project in Hermiston. And in some discussions with Calpine, it was a planning faux pas on their part that caused this to happen. They were hoping to be online quicker than what they were. Utility centrally assessed properties do not receive commercial facilities under construction. It was a budgeting issue for them, and they'd hoped to be online quicker than they were. So that was a project problem, not a problem with the process.
Okay.
Just for clarification purposes.
All right. Thank you. Let me invite Representative Johnson to come forward.
Mr. Chair, at this point, I have nothing to add. I'm just here in support of my commissioner and assessor on this bill, and I'll be back on another one.
Oh, okay. Well, if you want to hang around, we can go to it real soon. Okay. All right. Does anybody else want to talk on this? Here's what I'd like to do. We need to get this thing out of here, but if Paul, would there be a chance that we could try one more amendment to build a wall around this Calpine project section so that we don't disrupt the Columbia County issue and Coos County or wherever else this may have been? And if we can get one more amendment and schedule this for Wednesday or Thursday and try and get done with it that way. Does anybody else want to talk on 2299 while we're at it? Okay. You don't? Why don't we? That way, then, when we're ready, we can just blast through it when we get that last amendment.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Christina Squires on behalf of the Special Districts Association of Oregon. The Dash 8 amendment was brought to you by, just to clarify some concerns that the Association of Oregon Counties had, and specifically Washington County, regarding some of the language. All that Dash 8 does is on page, if you look on page 4 of the Angros bill, it's just deleting some language on line 7 through 8, after the word application, between the county and the city, if any, in which the eligible project is located. Just deleting that line for clarification purposes. They were more comfortable if the language was deleted, and then it is restated again in a different format, an agreement entered into, and we're talking about the community, the reimbursement fee. An agreement entered into this paragraph is effective only if, one, the county and the city in which the eligible project is located agree, and 75% of the taxing districts with levying authority collectively agree to that the way that community reimbursement fee would work. And why we put 75% in there, and that was already in the bill as it came over to you from the Trade and Economic Development Committee, why we did that was just to make sure that we were really talking about the people who have the money on the roll making the decision, not just one, no offense, cemetery district with 2 cents of levying authority, to make sure that the people who are really going to be truly affected by the exemption would be participating in that and not be able to tube the discussion in any way.
Okay. Did you have a question about that, Representative Verdi?
I did. I need to real clearly understand who has to agree and on what.
Mr. Chair, Representative Verger, who has to agree is, this is only dealing with the reimbursement fee. This is not about property tax exemption. This is on the negotiation that already takes place. It does already take place. Like, for instance, when Intel came in and under the Strategic Investment Program, they all collectively got together, Washington County, Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue. It did occur. All this language is doing is putting in statute, making sure that somewhere in statute it says that that fee will be negotiated among the city or the county and the affected taxing districts. And that's how this language would work. So it would be, say, for instance, City of Beaverton sponsored the strategic investor, was in City of Beaverton. City of Beaverton would have to agree to the community service fee, and if there were any taxing districts providing service, if the boundaries were totally within the City of Beaverton, if the taxing district serving City of Beaverton, so it would be Tualatin Hills Parks, and in this example, Tualatin Hills Parks and Recreation District, Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue, 75%, and let's say there was a cemetery district and a library district too that had a few cents on the roll. So the district taxing districts with 75% of the levy authority, the total levy authority for those ORS 198 districts, would have to agree with the City of Beaverton on how that community service fee would be paid back.
Follow up.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think that's fine, except that when you pass a bill and it goes into state law, it affects a lot more people than the city of Beaverton, and or the city, or Alpine, or anybody else. So that's one concern that I have, where we're being so specific about different areas, and then it might not have that same effect on others. But that's another time and another place. But thank you for that clarification.
I was just wondering, I know that the Washington County officials, and I don't see them here today, have had some heartburn over having a lot more people in the negotiating room when you deal with some of these agreements. I mean, these are huge deals. So the Intel SRP program negotiations involved a lot of very dicey and tricky negotiations. Their concern was, if you have 14 people in the room instead of four, that some of those agreements just might never be reached.
Come on up, Mike Burton. Go ahead, Ms. Ann.
Mr. Chair, Representative Haas, that's precisely why, that first of all, I'll just say that the language of the bill as originally written and negotiated prior to coming into the session allowed for special districts to opt out of these strategic investment programs, and some people got somewhat nervous over that, even though it was it was agreed to as the bill was filed. What we did to make people feel more comfortable was just not deal with the opt-out, since it is a big, as you point out, strategic investment program. We're talking about big investments, big dollars, big. We truly didn't want to have the cemetery district holding up this discussion on a big project like strategic investment program. So what we did was then place this language in exchange for the concern, try to move to something that made the big players be the people doing the negotiation on the community service fee, and that's why the 75% language was inserted. So you would have, and I just want to recognize that this isn't just the city of Beaverton type of issue. It would apply to city of Coos Bay, so you may have a small library district or a big fire district providing service. But the big affected taxing districts would be the ones that would be in the room talking. So you wouldn't have all 14 like the library and the cemetery.
Chair Shetterly, Representative Haas, I came up here to add that this really creates a two-step negotiation. The first one is between the city, county, and the business, and determines whether or not there's going to be a deal. So we aren't changing that. Once that's happened, then there's a discussion about what happens with this community service fee, which is the part this affects. All of the taxing districts with a stake in that come to the table. But for the sake of moving the project ahead and getting to certainty about whether or not there's going to be a deal there, that's already taken place by the time this happens. And we set this up as a mechanism so that you wouldn't have a large investment being blackmailed by this cemetery district. I don't know why Hacienda doesn't like cemetery districts.
Yeah.
But the point is to cut the business deal and then get about what are we going to do, how are we going to allocate the new resource that's coming in as a result of this very large investment.
Okay. And that's when you get into the broader negotiation among the taxing districts.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then as a fallback and a stick or carrot so that they can get to the place where they are in agreement, it would come to the Economic and Community Development Commission if after 90 days they can't reach an agreement.
All right. Thank you. Any other questions about these amendments? Then let's get this back up as soon as we can, see if we can solve that 34C issue. Is anybody else? Senator Ferrioli, what are you here for? Do you want to talk to us about 2299?
3610.
Thank you, sir. We'll get to that. Representative Johnson, is that your bill, too?
No, sir. My bill is 3551.
Okay. Mm. Let me close the work session then on House Bill, work on House Bill 2299. We'll get that back up as soon as we can. 3551,
yes, sir.
Come on forward. First in line, first in time, Representative Johnson. We'll open a work session on 3551. Now, I did get a note from Representative Krupp's staff that he wants to be here. He's going to be late, coming in at 9:30, so we'll just open this for the purpose of... Let me just do this. Okay, we'll take two of you since you're a Columbia County team here. All right, bring up one more team. Losing control of my agenda. 3551. Mazin, quickly, refresh us.
Mr. Chair, this is the bill that expands the property tax exemption for the ethanol production facilities and the proposal to expand that also to biodiesel,
right,
or biofuel, going from 50% in 5 years to 100% for 10 years.
Right.
Discussion was held to amend the bill in certain ways to allay some of the fears, but I have not seen any of these amendments.
I was going to say we don't have any amendments in front of us this morning. All right, well, Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, I'm here in my role as support staff to the capable A team from Columbia County, Commissioner Hyde, and our assessor, Mr. Linhares. I will defer to them.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Again, this is the same issue with the same enterprise zone and the same urban renewal plan as I just spoke of. We have a existing enterprise zone that allows the ethanol plant that we have currently pre-certified for 5 years of 100% exemption, along with up to 2 years during construction. That's not a problem for us. And we were aware of the bill that allowed for ethanol exemptions in there. We didn't feel that was going to be a double dip because it would, as currently written, would sunset before they would be eligible for the second subsequent 5 years. The way that it's rewritten, they would be eligible for another 5 years, which and now in talking of 50% reduction, if you use the math, means that they're going to have 15 years of 50% reduction. Now, that's not acceptable for us. That's not defensible. Politically, one, it's not something that I would support. And more importantly, again, we have a very delicate urban renewal plan within our enterprise zone that's written to provide the infrastructure for both this plant and the two power production plants that's reliant on the current strategy that we have. This would allow them to come in after 5 years of 100% deduction and then access a 50% exemption for another 5 years. That's the amendment that you're going to hear this morning. And again, that's unacceptable. My suggestion is that you have either or. With either or, then they're going to have essentially 10 years of 50% reduction by getting the 5 years of 100%. And that's fine with us. But the double dipping's not.
Okay. Tom? Nothing. Okay. Everyone's talking about amendments. We don't see any amendments, so we don't know what we're looking at here. Maybe Representative Crump will have some when he comes in. But Mr. Representative Barnard?
Thank you. I think what you're saying is that you have some improvements that the Urban Renewal District has to pay for, and that with this proposal, you won't be able to pay for them.
Right.
Isn't that what you're saying?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnard, that's exactly what I'm saying.
Right,
well, this is what we heard last week when we heard this, right? The same testimony.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we've got a cash flow problem.
Okay.
For the urban renewal.
We did say that.
Yeah. Okay. Well, now, Tom.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I don't want to steal Representative Krupp's thunder. The amendments we had talked about, because we got together, a whole group of us, in the afternoon. I don't want to, but I'm going to anyway.
Tom? You could never do it.
I appreciate that. Of course, my representative is no slouch herself. Thank you very much. I had suggested an either-or, just like Commissioner Hyde had suggested. Representative Krupp really wanted companies to have the advantage of both the 5-year 100% enterprise zone exemption and an additional 5 years under the ethanol production facility. That was sort of what was talked about, and I think that's what the amendments are going to say. I then suggested, under 10-year ethanol exemption, we're talking about first 5 years would be automatic, second 5 years would be up to the local jurisdiction's option. In a situation where there's an enterprise zone, where you have 5 years enterprise zone and then another 5 years of ethanol production, I wanted to have that at the local government option as well, and I think the amendments are going to come out to say, no, that's a total of 10 years, so they get that 5 years of ethanol production
automatically.
But if you just had that at the local government's option, that would solve our problem because we just wouldn't give them that second 5 years.
Okay. You heard it here. Okay. Any questions for these three? All right. We'll come back to this one then when we get Representative Krupp in the building. Thank you. We'll recess the work session on 3551. Senator Ferrioli again. 3610. We'll open a work session on House Bill 3610 and welcome Senator Ferrioli. Committee, this is the one that we have on loan from the Rules Committee. Puts it in a different posture than our other bills, but we need to get it back to them one way or another, and I hope we can do that today with some either recommendation or no recommendation. This was just on loan. Senator Ferrioli.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Ted Ferrioli from John Day and Points East. Senate Bill 3610 is an interesting bill. Now, I want to make very clear, I did not come to shoot this dog, but I do want to fire a shot over its little furry head and make it cock one ear.
Over its bow-wow.
Well, over its bow-wow, exactly, Mr. Chairman. I yield to your superior pen ability.
I didn't realize you were that late in the session yet.
Never give this guy 3 days. Never. Mr. Chairman, the bill raises an issue that I think needs exploration, and that is how do we tax and how do we incent wind power development? And representing a couple of the communities that are, in fact, becoming the western capital of wind power, I'm very anxious to make sure that we provide enough incentive, but that we also capture enough value for the local community. I mean, what's the point of having these wind power generation facilities come if they don't also produce income for the local community in the form of tax revenue? We have, in fact, worked very hard with the wind power generators that are facilitated and located in those sites to provide enterprise zones. We're working on a new mechanism for financing, which would be tax-exempt bonds. You know, currently that is not allowable on some of these projects for transmission facilities. You know, so we, as we explore the development of this new industry and make Oregon its capital, we hope that that will happen. We're finding new pieces and new parts that need to be added. But this one has a bit of concern, I think, that you may have heard expressed by the communities of Umatilla, Sherman, and Gillam counties, and that is that they are currently, these facilities are currently taxed on an ad valorem base for their value. The bill before you exempts wind turbines from property taxation, and that would put a big hole in the pocket of these communities that work so hard to attract these industries, because it is becoming a fairly significant source of local revenues. And as you know, that as the state of Oregon deals with its problem, we tend to cost shift to the rural communities or the local jurisdictions, cities and counties. And to disempower them is just exacerbating the problem. So I guess what I would suggest to you is that I think this bill deserves a, pardon the pun, an airing. I think this bill raises an important issue, and that is what should the future of taxation be. I think if we do anything, we have to hold harmless these communities that have already concluded a contract with these companies that are currently located there. And it was perfectly acceptable that we use the incentives that were already in our toolbox. So to do something retroactively would just overturn those partnerships and hurt those communities. So I guess what I'm asking the community or this committee to do is listen to the arguments. Anything that would be done certainly ought to be done prospectively, but there are some agreements in place that were already in place before this bill made its appearance before the legislature. And so I urge you to explore the fact that there were already agreements in place with Morrill County on the existing structure that the other twin turbines are located in those communities. And this bill was sort of a little surprise. So think hard, look forward, talk about the issue of taxation and what we ought to do. The difference is, do we tax the electrical energy that's produced by these facilities, or do we tax the facilities as we would any other permanent improvement that's been established in a community? We've done a great deal with tax abatement and enterprise zones and public financing already to try to bring these new technologies online in the Columbia Basin, which is a great wind opportunity. This bill before you is a change in direction. It's not necessarily supported by the local jurisdictions, although I think we ought to look at all the possibilities here. So again, I'm not here to shoot this dog. I just want to raise the issue that you do this retroactively and you're going to disempower these local communities. If you do it prospectively, you're going to change forever the playing field on bringing these facilities into the state of Oregon. And that may not necessarily be a bad thing. I just urge you to weigh the issues.
Okay. Good words. Questions or comments? For Senator Fraioli?
Okay. Have a nice day. Thank you very much for the opportunity, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the consideration.
You bet. Paul, before we go on, do we know, now that we've got this thing, how do we give it back to the Rules Committee? Does it take a motion, or is it just something from me? You want to check with Ramona, perhaps, what our process is? Okay. While we're in the work session on 3610, is there anybody here that did not speak last week? Yes. Come on forward. Good morning.
Good morning. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Bill Hansel. I'm a Umatilla County Commissioner. And unlike the senator that just spoke, I'd like that shot a little lower. I don't want a shot over the bow. I want a shot into the... A little bit about Umatilla County. If Oregon's becoming the capital of the wind energy facilities, Umatilla County is the capital of Oregon. Currently, we have 164 online producing. We'll have 60 more go online this year. And there are 104 in the process of being sited as I speak. Property taxes to our communities this year will be $1.5 million. That's to the schools, the special districts, Blue Mountain Community College, all the different ones that share in these ad valorem property taxes. And we would ask that you not take that away from us. It would be, as far as the figures that we've been able to come up with in Umatilla County, this would be a 35% reduction in what the companies would pay. None of it comes to us. It all goes to the state and then shared back with us on some type of formula. Umatilla County Board of Commissioners has gone on record as opposing 3610. The Association of Oregon Counties has gone on and opposed it as well. We have had absolutely no problems with incentives. The companies are coming because it's based upon the scientific evidence of the wind that's available. And the Van Sickle Ridge, the state line area, is some of the primary wind production capabilities in all of the United States, if not the world. We have been working around the clock in our planning departments to facilitate these companies that have been coming in. They have made contracts with the local landowners. We have worked extensively in setting up the wind energy activities within our county. There is to say that they won't come if there aren't some kind of incentives. We have simply not seen that at all. They want to come. They are coming. And in discussion with our first company, Florida Power, they are opposed to this bill as well. They feel that the property tax is the fair way to go. It gives them a known figure of what they have to do for the budget. So we would urge you to not support and vote against this particular bill, 3610. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Representative Shetterly, members of the committee, my name is Pat Shaw. I'm the assessor for Gillam County. We have a wind farm that's been online for a little over a year. We have 83 towers. In Gillam County, we work hard to get out economic development, but in our area and with our facilities, it's pretty hard to do. One thing we do have is wind. I put together a sheet, I don't know if you've received it or not, of the difference between the income that our taxing districts would receive with this in lieu tax, which is basically what the bill is talking about, versus an ad valorem tax. It's quite a reduction in value to our taxing districts. I'd like to hold just a minute until you get the information so I can go through it with you. This information is based on our site only. We have 83 towers. They produce 0.6 megawatts apiece, which is at full capacity would give us 49.8 megawatt hours. The capacity for our area is about 30%. They don't run at 100%. The wind doesn't blow all the time. And so the first line is taking the 49.8 megawatt hours, converting it to kilowatt hours, and converting it to an annual basis, and figuring in the 30% capacity. And the highlighted figure is the in-lieu tax that would produce. The second one is using a 24.6 capacity, which is what our site is rated at. The third one is a 22% capacity, which is what our site is year to date. Then down below the ad valorem tax, at full current value, which is market value, the ad valorem tax is the highlighted figure. Then at 80%, which was the figure originally I heard that most of these sites would be valued at with an ad valorem tax. And I also threw in a 50% of current value just to show what, in case it would go down to that. And then up toward the top where it says loss to districts, you can see that that's based on 80% of the current value, or what ad valorem tax would be based on. There's quite a reduction in either way you want to figure it. It's a huge reduction to our taxing districts. We don't have the opportunity to get economic development or technical development in our area. And future use of wind power is something we do have. But if this bill goes through, our taxing districts would suffer. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Any questions?
Chair Chenery, members of the committee, Mike MacArthur, Sherman County Judge. I think I've worked as hard as anyone to try and incent the wind industry and try and develop it in Sherman County. We think it is a great resource and a great opportunity in our county. The Columbia Plateau in general appears to have a great opportunity, but I think we need to be careful about the way that's developed. There isn't a lot of other resource in our area. We need to make sure that we maximize the benefit from this resource. The wind resource in Sherman County is sufficiently attractive that three developers are now leasing property or have options on property in Sherman County toward a future development. The biggest obstacle we have in Sherman County is the transmission. The only real way out in Sherman County is to tap into the 500 kilovolt line, which takes a huge amount of investment just in step up and connection capacity. So that takes a huge wind farm to amortize that over. We're willing to work with these projects on enterprise zone. They have federal production tax credit. Oregon has a unique tax credit, thanks to Senator Packwood, that can buy down almost 25% of the cost of a renewable project. I'd like to reiterate what Commissioner Hansel said. In my discussions with these developers, they aren't necessarily interested in this bill and this approach to taxation. We have a project in Sherman County, the Klondike project, that was originally valued at $19 million. It recently sold for $16 million. So we know that will likely depreciate over the 20 years, and they will be paying less property taxes over time. When the developers make their proposal to the people in the county during the conditional use permit process, one of the things they've been touting is the economic advantage to the county of having these projects there. It does change the landscape of our county. Some people are concerned about what that is doing to the sort of scenic beauty, I guess you will, of the county, to have these towers standing out on the hillside. I think the idea that they are providing some other benefit to the county to help us diversify our economies makes them look somewhat more attractive than they would were that not in place. So I urge the committee to recommend to the Rules Committee that this bill not move forward. Perhaps we need to have a larger discussion about wind energy and how best to incentivize it in Oregon, but we don't agree with this approach.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Okay. I appreciate you coming over today to talk to us. Does anybody else want to be heard on 3610 while we're in session on that? Committee, Paul has clarified to me the protocol here, and that would be not a motion or any action by committee directly, but a memorandum from me sending the bill back to the Rules Committee, expressing sort of the sense of the committee, I suppose, about it. And I, let me just start off. I think from our conversation about this last week, some concern on the part of the committee about the impact of this bill on local government anyway. I'm just guessing that was the, and the suggestion that this bill not move forward, at least not unamended, addressing impacts on local governments. If I can sort of get a nod of the heads, if anybody's strongly opposed to that, what I may do is plan on sending that memorandum over to the Rules Committee on Wednesday, and then if individual members want to express an opinion yourselves, if you want to get those memoranda to me, I will attach those to my memorandum to the Rules Committee and try to capture the fuller sense of the committee's concerns. But that would be my intention anyway, without some formal action of the committee. Representative Barnhart?
Well, there's one other issue, and it's one I don't understand fully, but I think it's an issue, and that is the potential for distortion of the business plan of the companies that are generating wind power because of the change from basically a flat amount per year of the property tax to a production tax. It's not clear to me what the effect of that would be, but that is some of the companies, even though they might get a reduction in the overall taxes, are opposed to that, raises a flag for me that I think that needs to be explored further. I'm not sure what it means.
Okay. And I think another thing we talked about last week was at least a further examination of this in the context of other tax incentives and credits at the, both at the national, the federal and state level that are available to wind production. Representative Hass?
Thank you. I agree and support what your memorandum idea. I just want to make it's absolutely clear that to the Rules Committee that this didn't come over and have a thorough hearing and was given back with a clean,
right.
Good housekeeping seal of approval from the Revenue Committee, and that there was some dissension.
Yeah, I think that'll be the sense of my memorandum expressing these concerns. And what I'll try to do would be to have something out maybe even by the end of the day today or tomorrow, let you take a look at it a day or so ahead, and if somebody has any serious concerns about what you see in the memorandum, then you can let me know. I don't want to.
I guess one question would be, why is it in the Rules Committee and not here?
Well, that you're asking the wrong person.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, last time we heard about amendments, but we have not
yeah,
seen
right, any. We've not seen any amendments. Okay. All right, well, that will be my intention then, committee, and again, I'll circulate that draft memorandum to you and invite you to submit to me any comments of your own that you would like to forward to the Rules Committee Chair, and we will send those over together, and I'll plan on doing that on Wednesday. Okay, close the work session on House Bill 3610. Thank you for that. Don't see Representative Krupp here yet, so let's wait off on 3278 and 3551. Let's try to pick up Senate Bill 327.
Okay.
That's still you, right, man?
Yes.
Okay, that's what I thought.
This is 327?
327.
Senator Messerly said he would like to speak, and he's right down the hall.
Oh, he is. Do you want to go? Where is he?
I wonder if I can get somebody to run.
Paul or Kathy?
Senator Messerly said he would like to come if he's available. He's in Education, Ways and Means, in right down the hall.
Okay. We'll open a work session on Senate Bill 327. Manson?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the Senate Bill 327, to refresh the memories, deals with altering the requirements of qualification for the non-urban enterprise zones. In the time of the high unemployment in the state, the being above the state unemployment level by 50% or being 1% higher than the previous year was a requirement. At this time, it seems to be non-attainable for many counties because of the high levels of statewide unemployment. This bill changes that, and at the same time, I'd like to say that this bill might be an intersection with 2299 in the sense that it puts forward the conditions for what is a non-urban enterprise zone, but it doesn't really change any of the, but it makes the requirements universal.
I think that's why I wanted to hear it today when we got back to House Bill 2299, not necessarily put them together, but just so we could hear them both in the same meeting. Representative Verger, did you want to speak any further on this?
I just wanted to say that you will notice that the Oregon Revenue Coalition does not oppose this bill, and one of the reasons is that they recognize that enterprise zones are very tied to jobs and job creation, which is a very important part and a thrust of this session. I think it does affect a number of counties, and I believe because of that, it is a policy that needs to stand on its own. I believe that if we get things too convoluted, that it's going to work both ways, bad for 327 and bad for 2299. So I think that because of this, it actually is not going to change that much, except that the counties, of course, that have this unemployment problem right now can certainly change that later on. But in order to have a difference, if you remember, we said it would have to be over 11.5% unemployment for the counties to comply with this, which is just exorbitant. So I think in order to protect the tool that counties have and in order to be able for them to proceed, Senate Bill 327 is extremely important. It has gone through the Senate, and it has and it is now with us. There will be some revenue impact, obviously, because anytime you have an enterprise zone that offers some exemptions. So Paul is back. I don't know if Senator Messerly could get free.
Okay. I don't think we do.
Okay.
Yeah. We're happy to have Senator Messerly, but I'm also happy to just go ahead and move this thing if the committee is ready.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hines?
I would move SB 327 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Hass moves Senate Bill 327 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there discussion on the bill? Okay. If not, please call the roll.
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Berger?
Aye.
Barr?
Hass? Aye.
Hopkins?
Aye.
Hatch?
Aye.
Berger?
Aye.
Williams?
Aye.
Aye. Senate Bill 327 goes to the floor of the due pass recommendation. Representative Verger, I assume you'd like to carry that. Okay, she will. All right, we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 327. We have our Treasury folks here today, so now is with us, and still no Representative Krupp, so let's go to HJR 18. Open a work session on that. It's been a while since we looked at this. Steve, you want to refresh us?
Yes.
Speaking of refresh, committee, for your information, Wednesday will be our last day for coffee in this committee. So our budget's being cut, and they're taking our coffee away from us. So you may want to tank up for these next couple of days.
It just makes me want to go get a cup right
now. I know. Drink ahead. All right, Steve.
Mr. Chair, members, for HJR 18, you should have a copy of the 18-2 that was handed out at the last meeting, I believe it was. That's the latest version.
Okay.
The dash 2 amendments revise the Constitution and then add language that it takes a two-thirds majority of both chambers to do that. The revision authorizes the state to issue general obligation bonds up to an amount not to exceed one half of 1% of the statewide value of real property, and then it requires that the bond proceeds be used to match local general obligation bonds raised for school district capital costs. The bonds then would be repaid from funds set aside by the legislature, from the general fund or other sources, and it prohibits that any property taxes be levied to repay those bonds. The second part of the bill deals with the creation of a capital matching fund. It sets up that fund and allows the legislature to make deposits as funds would be available, and then it requires that those funds be used for matching grants also for school district capital costs and payment of debt service. But for the capital matching fund dollars, there's no requirement that there be local general obligation bonds used in that matching process. It repeals the current school capital subaccount in the Education Stability Fund. So it does away with that and replaces it with the new capital matching fund. And then the funds that wouldn't go into the school stability subaccount are redirected into the new capital matching fund, so that when the stability fund is fully funded, then any overflow of lottery dollars that would have gone into the existing capital fund go into the new one.
And that's the coordination of the...
Correct.
This bit of this HJR and the...
Existing constitution. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Here's constitutional language. It defines capital costs as costs related to the acquisition, construction, improvement, remodeling, maintenance, or repair of public schools. And it requires that there can be implementing legislation passed by the legislature. And it requires that the measure be submitted to the voters at the May 2004 primary election.
Okay. It's been a while since we heard this. Let's invite our Treasury folks to come up and answer any questions or bring us up to speed on this as well. I know you've been around talking with members since we last heard this. One question I had, as you're getting seated, I know we essentially passed this, except for the revision part that coordinates this with the Stability Fund, and that's just technical. Inga, did you find out, what was the vote on this last session when we passed this out?
For the record, Inga Deckard, Oregon State Treasury. Mr. Chair, the vote was 51 ayes and 1 no.
What is it?
This.
Oh, yeah, please. All right. Any other questions? Did you want to bring us any new information about this? Okay. Representative Barnhart?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I understand, the difference between the dash ones and the dash twos, other than the restructure of the fund itself, is to consolidate the definition of capital. What's the word I'm looking for here? Capital costs between for the various purposes that. That funds could be spent in the local schools. Is that right, or have I misunderstood that in some way?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, for the record, I'm Cynthia Burns from the Attorney General's Office. And you're correct. This is an attempt to have the capital cost definitions for purposes of the bond proceeds that can be used to make a grant to school districts and the other monies that may come in through the Education Stability Fund, the purpose for which all of those monies could be used would be the same, because the same definition of capital costs would be the same. We were concerned that the existing definition of capital costs in connection with the Education Stability Fund would be linked to the meaning that's been given that term in Measures 5 and 50, which is a more restrictive definition than what we're using for this purpose, for the bond proceeds. So this is to help clarify that the bond proceeds and the Educational Stability Fund monies can be used for a slightly broader purpose with the definition of capital costs than can be used under Measures 5 and 50.
Okay.
Yes, sure.
Thank you. So if the Dash 1 amendments were to be approved and the bill go out, or the measure go out that way, we'd end up, in effect, we'd end up with two different definitions of capital costs one for the Stability Fund and one for the purpose of these bonds.
Without the dash twos, yeah.
Is that right?
Uh-huh.
The question I have really is, recognizing that that adds an increased complexity, is that a serious problem or a minor problem, or how would you characterize it in terms of the complexity for the purpose of actually administering these funds?
I'll answer from a legal perspective, Representative Barnhart.
That's what I'm after. Thank
Chair Shetterly. I think if we did not have these dash two amendments, we would have a clear definition of capital costs, which were put in connection with these bonds that can be issued to make grants to school districts. We would have a clear definition of capital costs, and as that's been defined through the history and the implementation of Measures 5 and 50. We think that then what would have happened in terms of there is no definition of capital costs for the Education Stability Fund, but we think the way it would be interpreted is that it would be given the same meaning as the term that was already in the Constitution when that was adopted, which was the more restrictive definition. So what it would mean in terms of administering these funds then, if they went through the Education Stability Fund and then passed down into the Department of Education to administer, would be a tracking problem. In terms of tracking, bond proceeds could be used to make loans to school districts for a broader purpose than monies from the Education Stability Fund could be used. So it would be a tracking issue. And then an issue of getting representations back from the school districts when the funds were granted in terms of, well, we're going to use the bond proceeds for these purposes, and we're going to use the Education Stability Fund monies for these purposes, so that we would get assurances from them continuing through that they would be used for the allowable purposes. So this makes it so that we don't have to get so many of those representations and do so much tracking.
If I may, then.
Yeah.
So the effect of this is that the construction for the broader purpose could actually get done. You would simply have to. It would simply require that there be more accounting in the process.
That's correct.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's kind of the layer of administrative complexity, I guess, in having the two separate funds, both administered essentially for the same purpose. Is Representative Hanks?
Yeah, just to clarify on the matching, this just clarifies that a matching fund will be created. It doesn't set into motion. We talked earlier about doing that next time out.
Yeah.
So why was that language added? I was just curious as to what that brings to the party in dash twos.
Representative Haas, Chair Shirley, I'm not sure which matching language you're referring to. Is that the name of the
school capital matching fund?
The name of the fund?
Yeah, it doesn't.
Oh. Yeah. The intent of this was simply to move the existing account out of the Education Stability Fund and create it as a new fund under what will be Article 11O of the Constitution.
Okay. It's fine. I just thought that was already covered. So when I saw this in the amendment, I thought that was...
Under the original HJR, that school capital matching account was in the Education Stability Fund and stayed there. And so the dash twos move it out from the Education Stability Fund, leave its purposes and everything else in place. They just move it from a sub-account of the Education Endowment Fund to a standalone fund on its own under Article 11O.
Gotcha. Thanks.
Okay. Anything further? All right. Well, we have the dash twos in front of us. Representative Hess?
Mr. Chair, I move the dash to be amended to HJR 18.
Okay, and I'm going to predict that we have objection from Berger, Scott, and Barnhart on the dash 2s.
Correct.
Okay, which leaves us with their end. Representative Barnhart?
Well, Mr. Chair, the reason that I have an objection to the dash 2s is that it appears to me as though we can accomplish the goal we have without going to the necessity of revising the Constitution. And I'm opposed to going to revisions if there are reasonable ways of getting there without doing that. Constitutional amendments, fine. Revisions, Let's save those for big things and flag them accordingly. That's my objection to the dash twos.
Okay.
And I wanted to stay it on the record.
Sure. But my understanding is you're okay on the bill or the resolution, assuming the dash twos get in.
Correct.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, you've boxed me at that point.
All right. Are there any other objections to the dash twos? Okay, the dash twos are in. Representative Hess?
Mr. Chair, I move HJR 18 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
And if we may include in that a motion to rescind the subsequent referral to Ways and Means, we've got a basically indefinite there or very small fiscal on this relating only to the election cost and not special election cost. This goes on a primary ballot.
Right.
So.
It's
okay. So that would be the included in the motion then to 18 as amended by the dash two amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the subsequent referral to the Ways and Means Committee be rescinded. And Representative Barnard, I appreciate your concerns on the twos, but also your support on the resolution. I think this is one where it's not a big deal, but it seems as long as we're putting back out a capital matching fund that, while we've got one in the Constitution already, it will save everybody administrative complexity and expense probably in the future to get these things coordinated so they're working together. I agree it's not a big thing, but I think it's something that while we've got the issue on the table, we can fix them both at the same time. Representative Berger?
I just want, Mr. Chairman, for the record to say that I believe that historically communities have been responsible for building and maintaining schools. And I believe that that is a very good system. And I believe that they will be much more willing to build and maintain facilities when we are able to provide the educational needs of their children, which at this point I do not believe we're doing. I believe that the way that you have to have matching funds, if it's going to go through, and let's say we're going to change history here, large populations are going to be able to come up with matching funds probably a lot easier, and I didn't see any criteria on need. So basically, the philosophical reason behind this bill, I just totally oppose. Until we talk about school funding and what we're going to put inside of those beautiful buildings that we're going to be building, and if we can't put teachers in there and we can't have the curriculum, we can't have art classes and music and the things that really make a total education, I am absolutely opposed to this. And I do believe once we establish a good educational system, that people in communities will step to the plate and will build new facilities as needed and will maintain the ones that they have. So.
Anything further, Representative Scott?
Thank you very much. I agree with Representative Berger. I believe that it needs to be more on a local issue, and until we are capable of funding them properly, I'm opposed to going out on a statewide basis and doing it.
Representative Pence.
Thank you. I just respectfully disagree with Representative Berger about the larger populations having the ability to do this easier. It's a larger population requires more schools. In Beaverton, for example, they've been building about two schools a year for the last 12 years, and they've really needed about three schools a year. And just because there's a larger population, then that really translates into a greater need. And the problem in some of the Portland metro area school district is that not only do you have the growth which necessitates more schools, but the real estate and other costs up there is so much more expensive. And I think creating an incentive for areas in Hillsborough, Beaverton, Coos Bay, Canby, or whatever is the same because it is population based. And I think this is a good signal that the state can send to people that we've asked to run our schools who are waving a white flag saying, what are you expect us to do here? And so I think this makes sense, and hopefully we'll voters will have a chance to decide whether we're right or wrong.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm stuck in the position where I think we need to do all of the above. I mean, we need to raise at least $1 billion this biennium that we don't have now in the budget to pay for the basic school budget. We need to also allow for the capital costs. Some school districts, like the ones that Representative Hass talked about, are growing like crazy and need to build new buildings just to deal with capacity. Other school districts have ancient structures that need to be replaced that are not earthquake-proof and that don't provide the needs anymore and that are going to be very expensive to replace. Some urbanized areas have relatively low assessed values. An example, believe it or not, the city of Eugene is about average on assessed value per pupil. Other districts like Central Lynn are very high on assessed value per pupil, and even though it's a much more rural area. So I don't think you can generalize between urban and rural in this regard at all. I think this is just one piece of the pie, and I hope we can do all of it. And one thing I absolutely agree with Representative Verger on, and that is that we've got to find more funds for the regular operating budget. Our schools are in deadly peril this year.
Any further comments? Okay. I'll just respond a couple. I agree. I think that with Representative Scott and Representative Verger, there's two issues. One is funding of schools, and the other is the issue of the state's participation in the capital, on the capital side. I just don't see HDR 18 as being opposed to the basic funding of schools. I think they're two separate issues, and one is necessarily antithetical to the other. And also on the issue of what kind of local participation is going to be required to qualify for these things, my only response there is that would be a matter to be decided by if the people approve the constitutional amendment. That's a matter for implementing legislation and rulemaking, and so it wouldn't be addressed in this anyway. So we'll have a chance, or the next legislature will have a chance, if this is approved by the people, to determine what that local match and local participation will need to be, assuming that, frankly, the next legislature would make the first decision whether they have the capacity at that time to issue any bonds in the first place. This just authorizes them; it doesn't create any debt, and that's something that would have to be determined at a different time and hopefully under a different environment. But with that said, I think we've talked this thing through. Let's call the roll. This is a 18 to the floor with as amended and rescinding the Ways and Means referral.
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Berger?
Aye.
Pass?
Aye.
Hopkins?
Aye.
Pass?
No.
Berger?
No.
Williams?
Aye.
Aye. HJR 18 as amended goes to the floor with the rescinding of the subsequent Ways and Means. Thank you, everybody, on that. Close the work session on HJR 18. Still no sign of Representative Krupp. Oh, there is. He's in the... I wasn't going to say it.
Yes, you were.
Let's bring him in. Oh, we need a carrier. I'll carry 18. So we'll open a work session on House Bill 3278. Mazen, are these both you anyway? Okay. It's 3278. When Elizabeth gets here. Thank you.
Why would that be?
Okay, Elizabeth.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, for the record, I'm Elizabeth Martin Mahar with Legislative Revenue Office. So we haven't really had a lengthy discussion yet on House Bill 3278. We had one on another pollution control bill. But basically, to go through some of the nuts and bolts of 3278, what it's doing is it deletes the sunset date for the pollution control credit by which the facility must be constructed or installed by December 31st, 2005. And it also deletes the requirements for the different tiers of the pollution control credit that is in current law. And as we had the last discussion, there was quite a few changes in the 2001 session, which then created these two different tiers, the upper tier having a 35% of the total certified cost credit and the lower tiers having a lesser amount, but the lower tiers being phased out. And so basically what this bill does is it deletes all those different tiers as well as the limit on the total certified cost of being $200,000 per pollution control facility. It increases then the credit percentage to 50% of the total certified cost for all pollution control facilities. It deletes then the requirement that applicants must have an environmental management system reviewed by an independent third party. It applies to pollution control facilities certified before or after the effective date of the 2003 Act, and to tax years beginning on or after January 1st, 2003. And it takes effect 91 days after the end of the regular session. So it does have a 2003-05 biennium impact as well as in the future. So it's a reduction of $758,200. Now, you have also a letter in here, just so you're clear, a letter from the governor dealing with this bill as well as the Dash 1 amendment. Now, what the Dash 1 amendment is doing is it's very similar to the Dash 2, but what the language it's doing is just allowing then the inclusion of building structures, installation, machinery, and equipment that's used to produce biodiesel. Bio oil or other fuel derived from the processing of agricultural crops. So that's basically then going to be included in the pollution control credit. Now, as the governor points out in his third paragraph here, under current law, biodiesel capital costs currently qualify for the business energy tax credit, which has 35% of the total certified cost can be claimed as a credit. So then basically you would be allowed this 35% for your business energy tax credit first, and then you would be allowed your remaining 65% of those total certified costs being allowed either the 35% or the 50% depending on whether you keep it at current law or you adopt the bill as it is. So that's one issue with the Dash 1. And then with the Dash 2, it's very similar to the Dash 1. The only difference is just really a small change in the language there. With the Dash 2 on page 2, you can see that it's just it includes a little broader definition or from food processing or from rendering waste. So it also includes just food processing or rendering waste also being included as a pollution control facility. So basically with your revenue impact, I haven't gotten to the point of really trying to add a little bit for this the biodiesel and bio oil and things and that component. This was just on the existing bill of increasing that credit percentage from 35% to 50%.
Okay. All right, Representative Krupp, welcome back. Do you want to talk about both this and 3551? Yes, let me open a work session on that as well then. Kathy? I'll open 3551 too. We'll be in work session on both of these so we can talk about them both together.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, I'm State Representative Jeff Krupp, House District 17. My apologies for not being here in a more timely manner. Mr. Chair, I've had a very sustained battle over the weekend with the flu, at which I have been sleeping a lot and on pain meds and eating a lot of chicken soup. And I would ask the indulgence of the chair and the committee that you would not take advantage of me in my weakened state.
Any objection?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let's start with House Bill 3278. Basically, this is obviously the companion piece, as we talked about in our biofuels presentation the other day. What I'm going to ask you to do, Mr. Chair, is basically ignore this bill at this point in time. I have reached agreement with the governor's office over the weekend to allow the basically the inclusion of the biofuels, bio-oils language that is on the page number 2 of the Dash 2 amendment.
Okay.
In the current proposal that is winding its way through the building regarding the pollution control tax credit, keeping in mind that there will be no, expansion of the 35% as I had originally proposed in House Bill 3278. So that number will stay constant. Basically, we're going to amend this language into that bill for the purposes of advancing the cause of what we're trying to do. Neither 3278 or my Dash 2s, unfortunately, have the provision that will be added in my amendment to the current bill, Pollution Control Tax Credit Bill, that this particular definition of allowing biofuels facilities will not take effect. Just that provision will not take effect until the 05-07 biennium. I do not desire there to be any impact on the 03-05 biennium by the inclusion of this. So that amendment will reflect that, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Again, basically, this is for the purpose of trying to bring into the entire concept of pollution control tax credit facilities and processes that are used for biofuels that eliminate or reduce greatly the pollution that is derived from the burning of fossil fuels. I think it's certainly in keeping with the direction we're trying to head. Mr. Chair, in regards to House Bill 3551, there are Dash 2 amendments that are coming to you.
Today?
Yes, momentarily. They're being copied as we speak, as I have just received them from Legislative Council. I want to state my appreciation to Dexter Johnson for his good work on this. He has noticed, Mr. Chair, a major flaw that seems to have escaped all of us for some time now. The relating clause of House Bill 3551 says relating to property tax exemptions for ethanol production facilities. And if you observe in the Dash 2s, which you will see momentarily, biofuels means biodiesel, biooils, and that does not, however, fit within the ethanol statute relating clause. So thereby, Mr. Chair, I can tell by the pained expression on the chair's face.
We've all been caught by that.
Yeah, that is somewhat problematic. What I am doing is currently feverishly, not to
literally
pun, feverishly, and by the way, I don't think I'm contaminative at this point.
I am cognizant of the distance between.
But I am a fair distance from the chair, so at any rate, it appears we'll be looking for another vehicle with which to amend that language into. Let me tell you what we have done after we had our last hearing with you, and you, I think, have heard some prior testimony that would allude to that effect. We put together a large work group. We sat down and talked for about an hour and 45 minutes to come up with the concept of how could we allow an expansion that would work within the confines of utilizing the Enterprise Zone statute and utilizing the current ethanol statute. And as you're seeing, you'll have the copy of the Dash 2s in front of you momentarily. Basically, Mr. Chair, what my desire is to, in not every instance, is the enterprise zone applicable or desired to be used by someone who would want to establish either an ethanol or a biodiesel facility. So given that, what I wanted to ensure was that there would be a 10-year program whereby, and I think this reflects my original testimony in front of this committee, that 10 years is that time frame that a lot of the financial institutions that would be financing these facilities would desire to have in terms of a payback time period. Anything beyond that, I think, Mr. Chair, would be somewhat counterproductive if you can't sustain in a free market enterprise in a capitalistic society, a return on your investment in 10 years, I don't think you probably should be doing this anyway. So that was my intention, is to create the opportunity for a Mazen's looking at me. if you The intention was to create a maximum of a 10-year provision whereby a company could use the enterprise zone current statute and then could also make use of the current or expanded ethanol statute. And that's what we've tried to achieve in the Dash 2, Mr. Chair. We have a provision in there, and part of our agreement with local governments was that should you use the two of these together, enterprise zone and the ethanol statute together, the expanded ethanol statute that I am proposing, that local government, for that second 5 years of what we're proposing in the ethanol statute, the optional 5 years, would have the opportunity to come together as a group, the affected taxing districts, and approve of that up front. And that's what we're trying to achieve here. It was not my intention that we would have anything longer than a 10-year time period. So let me just say, for instance, you had a 3-year enterprise zone exemption at 100%. If in keeping with my concept of 10 years, at the same time you were negotiating your enterprise zone for 3 years, you would also then be negotiating perhaps 2 additional years for your ethanol. And I'm hoping, Mr. Chair, that I'm explaining this with some common sense, again, given my foggy state of mind. Under the current ethanol statute, which does expire at some point in time here, my intention was that if you had 3 years of enterprise zone, you would automatically be granted under the current ethanol statute, depending on your time frame, an additional 5 years at 50% for 5 years. If at that time you were desiring to, that would give you obviously 8 years total, Mr. Chair. So if you wanted to go the full 10 years, you would at that time, when you were negotiating all of this right up front, so that all the local governments knew what was coming down the road and everyone had their cards above the table here, you would negotiate with them. And the language on page 3, Mr. Chair, under section 2, right, talks about how we could achieve that. As you well know in this committee, the problem is that a local government, a local taxing district, cannot encumber another local taxing district. And so trying to find a way to get around that, the state obviously can. The state can grant those types of property tax exemptions. So what we did was create a mechanism where the Economic Community Development Department could, in essence, extend the extra 5 years if, and you start in line on line 17 of page 3, there's a consensus among the majority of the local taxing districts having territory within the ethanol or biofuels production facility is located that an extended period of exemption should be granted. And you move on down to sub B, authorizing that, line to 25, a majority consensus is based on the property tax authority. So basically, Mr. Chair, if you had your county and your water district, the majority of the taxing district said, yes, we think this is a fair idea up front, you could make this happen. If you had to include every taxing district, you could have a small cemetery district that would object, and then you could stop the whole project. We felt that if you could get a majority of consensus of those who actually are involved, that you could actually then move forward with the project. We felt that was basically our compromise that we agreed upon. Now, keep in mind, Mr. Chair, this amendment is hot off the press, so to speak, and it is in keeping, I believe, with the only mechanism whereby we could allow local districts to agree to the extra extension of the property tax credit in that regard.
So the intent here is to provide that extended period be a local option.
That is correct.
Based on,
yes,
on
Mr. Chair,
approval of the local district.
That's right.
I see in here, and again, granted that you've only seen this for the first time too, that school districts, education service districts, community college districts, and community college service districts not be considered local taxing districts for the purpose of this extension. What was the? I mean, I don't know. Are they typically part of the group that agrees on they're not okay.
No.
So this is consistent
with
enterprise zone and other. Okay, I just wanted to make sure. Okay.
That we wanted to stay consistent. Okay.
I agree with that. I didn't know for sure. The other thing I've got, and either for you or the smart people behind you, this language here: consensus among a majority. Is that current language too on local options? I mean, consensus among a majority seems a little bit awkward.
Very.
Well,
yeah, right. Uh-huh. But why not just agree with 51% or something like that? What's the issue of consensus among a majority? And unless that's just common language, it's already understood as to what it means.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Hasina Squires on behalf of the Special District Association of Oregon. First, want to acknowledge Representative Krupp's diligent work in trying to maintain local authority to choose whether or not our taxes are preempted or not. And here comes the smarty pants who understands the words that are on the piece of paper. Our intent was to, again, as we were talking about in 2299, make sure that it was the majority of the, and Gil and I, as we were reading these, as we just got them, as Representative Krupp did, these amendments, we might need a little amendment in here that would say the county and a majority of the other taxing districts, because we have a real-life scenario where actually in Columbia County, Clatskanie and I Fire District would be the majority of the taxing district, not the county, with the taxing levy authority. We didn't realize that. So we do have a little wordsmithing
to do
here.
Well, while this amendment looks for another home, you can continue to work on that. Okay. Gil?
Mr. Chair, for the record, Gil Riddell, Association of Oregon Counties. I also want to thank Representative Krupp for working with us. I must say, though, as he knows, AOC has not seen this or weighed in on this. We're doing that right now, as we speak, over in the local government center. And I just second what Hasina said about the real-life situation that we found, that in fact, we would prefer county plus the majority of the other special districts. And there's also an ambiguity that we need to discuss with the representative that affects the current agreement, again, with Columbia County, that delicate agreement. And we need to – this also will affect that in a way that we hadn't anticipated. So
we'll be happy to let you work that out. Again, it sounds to me like sideboards or something, just to make sure that we don't have any unintended consequences. Well, I appreciate everybody's effort on this. Let me just clarify then with House Bill 3278. We will be amending that language into 2652, which is the other pollution control tax credit. So 3278 will not go forward. And then 3551, happily, we have a few spare relating to taxation relating clauses hanging around the committee. So I'm sure staff can help you find a suitable home and then continue to work on the amendments, I guess, to deal with these particular issues as that gets forward. Very good. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
Do you want Dexter to address?
Yeah. Dexter is here? Yeah. Dexter. Let's have you. And since I asked the question.
Thank you both.
Dexter.
Mr. Chair, members, good morning. Dexter Johnson, Legislative Council Office. The question was about the consensus language.
Is that standard language out of other local option kind of property tax issues? Why not just a majority, the county plus a majority or something like that?
Mr. Chair, it isn't standard, although I would have to say actually there isn't. There really isn't standard language for, quote, local option, which is there's a number of different ways you can approach a local option property tax set up, but this one is, I think, kind of unique. There's a couple of points I want to stress. One, this is not this is a Economic Development Department decision. It is not a local government decision. The department is not required to under this language, and I think there would be a problem if they were required. It is not required to grant the extension based solely on whether there is consensus among the districts.
It has to qualify for other
Well, they have to independently determine that it will promote economic development, et cetera.
The consensus is just a predicate.
Correct.
There are other considerations that have to be taken into account. Yeah.
Correct. And the real problem is the notion that you really can't have, whether it's a county or anybody else, making decisions on what the taxes of another local taxing district should be. And that's why this is very flexible language that they should take a look at this, but not that there's no requirements here.
I guess, Dexter, maybe I'm still struggling with how do you define what a consensus?
Yeah.
I mean, it's the language of you know, I mean, who gets to say when, you know, I thought I've reached consensus in this body lots of times, but when it comes time to the vote, I often find I'm disappointed. So how do you define that? I mean, wouldn't it be better just to put a numerical superiority standard in the bill so that everyone would know that when you got to, you know, 50% plus one, that was going to rule?
Still recognizing that the department would have its own...
But at least that's a numerical superiority that then the department knows that there is at least 50% plus one of the folks involved in this decision who have come to an agreement about this, as opposed to sort of that more squishy consensus.
Mr. Chair, Representative Williams, that's true, but that's inconsistent with the idea that you can't have local one or a group, but not all of local taxing districts making decisions that affect the other local taxing districts.
But didn't we do that in the Portland housing exemption? We did that.
Mr. Chair, that, and I have been saying this for a number of years, that...
You don't need to say this on the record if you don't want to.
Okay. Well, maybe I could. I'll just say that's been existing law for many years.
Okay. All right. Well, you will have some time to work this out. We don't need to wordsmith it between now, but we'll see this then as an amendment to another bill. I think it just surfaced some issues. Anybody else want to... thank you very much, both of you.
Sure.
Want to be heard on 3551 or 3278?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm putting on a totally...
I'm sorry, your name, please.
Marcia Kelly. And I'm putting on a totally different hat just for some informational purposes for the committee. The City of Salem, Marion County, and the Transit District, and I believe there are a couple of other entities, have in the past had a property tax management plan, and everyone gets together and talks about it and then adopts it. And so that might be a model that you could use rather than consensus. So you could talk to the city or the transit district regarding that, or the county.
Okay. Thank you, Marcia.
You're welcome.
Representative Shetterly, members of the committee, I'm Mark Kendall, a policy analyst for the Oregon Office of Energy, and I'm here this morning on behalf of our director, Michael Graney, to speak with regards to House Bill 3551.
Okay.
That ethanol and biodiesel markets in the United States are emerging as principal fuels, and they're experiencing a lot of volatility and competition. Ethanol is historically an oxygenator, an additive to gasoline commodities here in Oregon, and there rapidly is an elimination of its competitor oxygenate, methyl tertiary butyl ether, which has caused a lot of groundwater contamination in a lot of parts of the United States, but not yet in Oregon. And that elimination is driving up the need to develop new stocks of biofuels. These cleaner fuels, biodiesel and ethanol, yield a reduction in carbon dioxide emissions of 100% or 50% reduction over gasoline and diesel. We see that this ban on methyl tertiary butyl ether, some emerging science called biocatalysis, where you can turn cellulose, virtually straw, into gasoline or into ethanol, is becoming commercially available. And if Oregon is going to compete in that marketplace in a volatile volatile marketplace, in a marketplace that's emerging. It's not like adding another food processing industry where there's already a burgeoning consumer awareness. But that Oregon has the opportunity. We have a lot of the feedstocks that in many cases are going to waste that could produce economic stimulus for the state of Oregon and provide us with very lucrative alternatives in our agriculture and food processing industries.
Great.
So,
all right, thank you very much. Anybody else before we close the work session? Obviously, we will not be taking action on this today. We will see it in another guise, so stay tuned. All right, then, committee, with that, I'll close the work session on House Bill 3278 and House Bill 3551. And Representative Barnhart.
Mr. Chair, I note that we don't have anything scheduled for Wednesday, Thursday, or Friday. Is that
stay tuned.
Does that mean we're out of business?
No, we're not out of business. We're just looking at a shorter horizon.
Ah, thank you, sir.
All right. Okay, with that, we are adjourned. Thank you, everybody.